3 in 5 Americans report feeling lonely. In Japan, elderly women deliberately commit petty crimes just to go to prison, not for rebellion, but for companionship. In Britain, 2/5 of older people say their main form of company is the television. These aren't isolated stories. They're symptoms of what's become the defining crisis of our era. Even before the pandemic forced us into physical isolation, we were already living through an epidemic of disconnection that transcends age, wealth, and geography. The loneliest among us? Not the elderly we might expect, but Generation Z, young people who've grown up in the most connected era in human history. This paradox reveals something profound. We've confused digital connection with human belonging, and the cost of that confusion is written in our bodies, our politics, and our communities. Loneliness triggers physiological warfare. Stress hormones surge, blood pressure spikes, inflammation rises. This evolutionary alarm once protected ancestors from isolation's dangers, but chronic activation becomes toxic. Lonely people face 29% higher heart disease risk, 32% higher stroke risk, and 30% higher premature mortality. Yet Israel's Haredi Jews defy expectations, despite heavy smoking, high-fat diets, minimal exercise, and widespread poverty. They live 4 years longer than predicted. Their secret? Extraordinarily tight community bonds, praying together, celebrating together, supporting through crisis. Only 11% report loneliness versus 23% of other Israelis. Similarly, 1950s Roseto, Pennsylvania enjoyed half the national death rate despite terrible diets and factory work. When community bonds later dissolved, death rates climbed to average. The lesson? Connection isn't optional luxury, but biological necessity. When we give kindness, we trigger our own helper's high, energy, warmth, calm. Our bodies are designed for togetherness. Isolated mice become violently hostile toward newcomers, and humans aren't so different. Hannah Arendt, fleeing Nazi Germany, identified something crucial. Loneliness fuels political extremism. Totalitarianism bases itself on loneliness, finding adherence among those cut off from normal social relationships. In 2016, Trump voters were far more likely than Clinton or Sanders supporters to say they just rely on myself, rather than community networks. Railroad workers like Rusty, Gary, and Terry, lifelong Democrats who switched, felt personally hurt by policies that ignored them. Trump's rallies functioned as community rituals, where generations gathered, singing, and chanting together. For people whose traditional identity sources had vanished, stable jobs, thriving communities, respected roles, these rallies offered belonging. This pattern extends across Europe. People in civic associations are far less likely to vote for right-wing populists. When we feel abandoned, we become receptive to leaders offering not just recognition, but enemies, immigrants, elites, the other to blame. Populists weaponize loneliness, understanding it means lost status, dignity, and purpose. Over half of Londoners and New Yorkers report feeling lonely, echoing Thomas De Quincey's description of 19th century London's utter loneliness amid countless faces. Cities haven't improved at fostering connection, they've worsened. By 2050, nearly 70% of humanity will live in urban areas, making this crisis increasingly urgent. Dense populations erode civility. When we're unlikely to see strangers again, courtesy diminishes. Overwhelmed by sheer numbers, we withdraw, headphones in, eyes on phones. Urban walking speeds have increased 10% since the early 1990s, yet brief encounters matter. When researchers instructed Starbucks customers to chat with baristas, even these 30-second interactions increased happiness. The problem is urban transience. London tenancies average 20 months. Nearly a third of New Yorkers moved within 3 years. This churn prevents neighbors from bonding, reducing trust and community participation. Solo living dominates cities. Over half of Manhattan residents live alone, with similar patterns in Tokyo, Munich, Paris, and Oslo. Mealtimes trigger acute isolation, evidenced by skyrocketing single-portion meal sales and the global mukbang explosion, watching someone eat on screen while dining alone. We gain self-determination, but sacrifice opportunities to develop pro-social skills that make democracy work. We check our phones 221 times daily, spending over 3 hours on them, 1,200 hours yearly. Half of teens are almost constantly online. Former Facebook president Sean Parker admitted their explicit goal was to consume as much of your time and conscious attention as possible. Every moment scrolling prevents vital social interactions that make us feel seen. Device-distracted parenting causes delayed motor skills and attachment problems in children. A phone's mere presence measurably reduces empathy between couples. One Ivy League president became so concerned about incoming students' inability to read facial cues that he implemented remedial How to Read Faces classes. Ironically, Silicon Valley parents lead the screen-free childhood movement. Steve Jobs limited his children's technology. Bill Gates prohibited phones until 14. Many tech executives send children to screen-free Waldorf schools, while lower-income teens accumulate 2 more daily screen hours than affluent peers. At work, 40% of office workers worldwide report loneliness. Nearly 1 in 5 U.S. workers have no workplace friends. Open plan offices, marketed as collaborative spaces, actually increase alienation. When employees moved from cubicles to open layouts in one Harvard study, workers socially withdrew and communicated more through email. Workplace surveillance has become pervasive, with call center workers monitored for speech pace and empathy, and bank associates wearing biometric badges recording conversations every 16 milliseconds. Workers describe feeling dehumanized and like robots. Glastonbury sells out in 34 minutes, 135,000 tickets gone before lineup announcements. Devotees endure uncomfortable conditions annually, drawn not by music, but by powerful community, reflecting a counter-movement against digital isolation. Corporations have noticed, co-opting community language as marketing. Apple rebranded stores as town squares with avenues and forums, a lexical takeover of civic spaces. WeWork mentioned community 150 times in their failed IPO prospectus. Co-living spaces market with slogans like "Be More Together," even listing community as a service package item. The fundamental problem: community cannot be purchased. It requires active participation. Many co-living and co-working residents report disappointing connection levels. One gig economy worker described sitting alone among strangers, all wearing headphones. When commercialized communities do create belonging, they typically exclude those unable to afford entry. Boutique fitness classes cost up to $40 per session. Glastonbury tickets cost $330, Coachella $429 plus fees. Commercialized communities transform connection into a luxury good rather than a fundamental human right. 40 years of neoliberal capitalism normalized indifference, intensified by COVID-19. Yet hope remains through capitalism centered on care. Governments must invest in welfare, healthcare, education, and meaningful work. Trade unions must amplify workers' voices. Democracy must extend beyond voting into daily life. Rwanda's Umuganda program demonstrates this. Monthly, citizens spend 3 hours on community service, then discuss local issues, building bridges across differences. But society isn't just shaped top-down. We create it too. Personal responsibility matters, bringing cookies to work, putting away phones, and inviting neighbors for coffee. Communities thrive on repeated face-to-face interactions, transforming strangers into neighbors. We need a fundamental shift, from consumers to citizens, takers to givers, observers to participants. The antidote to the lonely century isn't just programs, it's us being there for each other. In a world engineered for isolation, connection becomes resistance. Your neighbor, coworker, the barista, they're not interruptions, they're the cure. Loneliness is a collective wound, requiring collective healing, beginning the moment you look up and see the person right in front of you.